All right, everyone, ready for another deep dive? Today, we're stepping into a period that truly shaped modern Northern Ireland, 1943 to 1963.
A pivotal era, no doubt. We're talking about society rebuilding after the tumult of World War II, grappling with the promise of change, and confronting those deep-seated divisions that, well, they kind of cast a long shadow.
And it's a period often overshadowed, right? I mean, most folks jump straight to the Troubles, but those two decades before, they're crucial for understanding how everything unfolded.
Absolutely. It's like laying the groundwork, seeing how a nation tries to redefine itself amidst the remnants of global conflict. Progress, yes, but also a hefty dose of missed opportunities.
So let's rewind to 1943. What's the scene in Northern Ireland?
Well, they're still feeling the effects of the war, obviously. The Belfast Blitz, for one, left its mark. But they're also about to navigate a major transition in leadership.
The changing of the guard, so to speak.
Exactly. Lord Craigavon, their prime minister for over 20 years, had passed away the year before. His successor, John Miller Andrews, he had a tough act to follow. And, well, let's just say his time in office wasn't without its critics.
Setting the stage for someone new to step into the spotlight.
Right. And that someone was Basil Brooke, who'd later become Lord Brookborough. Inheriting a society still grappling with the aftermath of war, the weight of expectations on him, immense.
You can bet. And speaking of those wartime contributions, Churchill himself recognized Northern Ireland's role, didn't he? Especially with the whole Battle of the Atlantic and all that.
Oh, absolutely. And he didn't mince words. He said, and this is a direct quote, "But for the loyalty of Northern Ireland, we should have been confronted with slavery and death, and the light which now shines so strongly throughout the world would have been quenched."
Wow. That's quite the statement. Churchill's basically saying that Northern Ireland's resilience helped prevent a global catastrophe.
Exactly. His words weren't just wartime rhetoric. They solidified a bond between Britain and Northern Ireland. The question became, would that bond translate into a better future for all of Northern Ireland's citizens?
Right, because even with victory, things across Europe were far from stable. The war might be winding down, but a new kind of anxiety was brewing. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Britain's, for example, their traditional industries, things like shipbuilding and textiles, they were already struggling before the war. Now it was even worse. People were facing hardship, and the fear of another economic downturn like the one after the First World War, it was palpable.
So people are bracing themselves for another round of hardship. I imagine that created an atmosphere where a bold idea could either take root or fall completely flat.
And that's where the Beveridge Report enters the picture. Published in 1942, it was like a beacon in all that uncertainty. See, this economist, William Beveridge, he had this radical idea, a social insurance system to act as a safety net for every person in Britain. Rich or poor, everyone deserved security.
This wasn't just tweaking the existing system. This was a complete overhaul of how society took care of its people.
Exactly. It was the blueprint for what would become the welfare state, a system promising health care, education, social security for all. And a certain political party, one gaining traction at the time, well, they took notice.
The Labour Party.
The very same. They saw the Beveridge Report as a way to reshape British society, and they ran with it. In the 1945 general election, they campaigned on this promise of a fairer Britain, one built on the principles of the welfare state.
And the rest, as they say, is history. Labour won that election by a landslide, a victory that would have ripple effects far beyond mainland Britain. Across the Irish Sea in Northern Ireland, a new set of questions emerged.
Exactly. How would Northern Ireland's leaders, those staunch unionists, reconcile their vision for their nation with this new wave of social reform sweeping through Britain? That's the story for our next part.
So the Labour Party, they're riding this wave of support for a more equitable society, and Northern Ireland's kind of caught in the middle of it all.
Right. Smack dab in the middle. Imagine it. That you're a unionist leader, deeply committed to the union with Britain, but also a little unsure about these grand social programs. It's a real balancing act.
Because they couldn't just ignore what was happening across the Irish Sea, could they? Those promises of social safety nets, they must have resonated with people in Northern Ireland, too.
Oh, absolutely. The desire for a better life, it transcends borders, right? And that's where the Attlee-Brookborough Agreement of 1946 comes in. It's a pivotal moment in this whole story.
Okay, so let's break down this agreement. Who are the main players we're talking about?
On one side, you've got Clement Attlee, British Prime Minister, fresh off that Labour victory. He's representing this new vision for a welfare state.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other, there's Basil Brookborough, Prime Minister of Northern Ireland. Staunch unionist, cautious, but also pragmatic.
So what kind of deal did they strike?
It boils down to this. Northern Ireland gets the same welfare provisions as the rest of Britain. We're talking National Health Service, Social Security, the whole shebang. A commitment, at least on paper, to a more equitable society.
Sounds like a win for Northern Ireland, but there's got to be a catch, right? I mean, nothing's ever that simple.
Oh, you know it. The agreement came with a price tag. Literally. Northern Ireland had to increase its own taxes to match Britain's and submit their budgets to the British Treasury. Closer financial ties in exchange for social progress, you could say.
And this is where things get really interesting, because it's not just about policies and agreements. It's about how those policies play out in a society already grappling with these deep divisions.
100%. Let's take healthcare.
Sure.
Before the NHS, access to good healthcare in Northern Ireland, spotty at best. The establishment of the Northern Ireland Health and Social Care Service in 1948, that was revolutionary.
People could finally see a doctor without worrying about the cost. Can't overstate how big of a deal that was for families.
Absolutely. And the impact. Look at the fight against tuberculosis. Before the NHS, TB was a scourge in Northern Ireland. But with this new focus on public health, mortality rates plummeted. We're talking a dramatic drop from 83 deaths per 100,000 people in 1946 to a fraction of that by 1959.
Wow, that's incredible. But you mentioned earlier that these seemingly positive changes could also expose existing tensions. How did that play out in healthcare?
Well, not every institution embraced the NHS wholeheartedly. The Mater Hospital in Belfast, a Catholic institution, they had concerns. They feared losing autonomy, worried about conflicting religious teachings, especially on things like contraception.
So they chose to stay separate from the NHS altogether.
They did. Relied on funding from the Catholic community, philanthropy, even football pools, if you can believe it. But this decision, understandable in its own right, it created some resentment. Some Catholics felt like they were paying twice, once through their taxes for an NHS they couldn't fully access, and again, to support their own institutions.
It just goes to show implementing these sweeping reforms in a society where different communities have their own needs, their own perspectives, it's messy. And it wasn't just healthcare. Education, too, saw its share of changes and, well, hiccups during this time.
Right. You've got the 1947 Education Act. On the surface, a huge step forward. Education compulsory until age 15. More equitable, right? But then they introduced the 11-plus exam, this seemingly objective test that ended up, well, reinforcing existing divisions.
Hold on, how did that happen?
Well, this 11-plus exam, it determined what type of secondary school you went to. Grammar schools, seen as the path to university, or secondary modern schools, focusing on vocational skills. Now, Catholic schools, even with increased funding, they still lag behind in resources, so Catholic children, disproportionately channeled towards those secondary modern schools, limiting their future prospects.
A system meant to create opportunity, but because of these underlying inequalities, it ended up perpetuating them. And this pattern, this unintended consequence, we see it pop up again with housing, right? After the war, Northern Ireland was facing a severe housing crisis. What was done to address that?
It was a dire situation. Imagine this, a 1944 report found something like 45,000 homes unfit to live in. And that's on top of the destruction from the Belfast Blitz. So what did they do? They created the Northern Ireland Housing Trust in 1945.
Sounds promising.
It was a massive undertaking.
Yeah.
Over the next 15 years, they built over 113,000 new homes. A remarkable achievement, really, given the circumstances.
But were these new homes truly available to everyone?
That's the million-dollar question. Mm-hmm. And the answer is, well, complicated. The housing trust itself, they aim to be fair, providing housing based on need, but the allocation of those homes often happened at the local level.
And that's where things get a bit, shall we say, less equitable.
Unfortunately, yes. Some local authorities, especially in Protestant-majority areas, they engaged in discriminatory practices, prioritizing Protestant families over Catholic families. This was particularly prevalent west of the River Ban, which further fueled that sense of marginalization in those communities.
It's that west of the ban issue cropping up again, highlighting the disparities in how policies were implemented on the ground.
Exactly. It's a reminder that even with the best of intentions, progress doesn't always trickle down evenly. And it wasn't just housing or even healthcare where this sense of inequality festered. It extended to social welfare, too.
So even with these new safety nets, the playing field still wasn't level?
Not quite. The 1947 National Insurance Act, it introduced these social insurance contributions, providing assistance to the elderly, the unemployed, widows, orphans. But anecdotal evidence suggests that the distribution of these benefits, well, it wasn't always even-handed. Some Catholic areas seem to receive less generous benefits compared to Protestant areas.
It's like this recurring theme, isn't it? The good intentions, the policies on paper, they only get you so far. The human element, the biases, they always seem to find a way to seep in. And amidst all of this, you have this desire for a united Ireland, still very much alive in the hearts and minds of many. How did these economic and social policies impact that aspiration?
That's the question, isn't it? And it's one we'll unpack as we explore the voices calling for change, the challenges to the status quo, and the events that would ultimately set the stage for those tumultuous decades to come.
We were talking about the complexities of progress, right? How these grand social programs, they didn't always land evenly across Northern Ireland. But alongside all of that, there were massive shifts happening in their economy too, weren't there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about it. The war upended everything. Yeah. And for Northern Ireland, a region so reliant on traditional industries, they're in for a bumpy ride.
Because these industries, shipbuilding, linen production, those were the bread and butter for generations, and they were already facing challenges before the war even began.
Exactly. And the war just accelerated those challenges. The rise of synthetic fabrics like nylon, devastating for the linen industry, and increased global competition. Shipbuilding felt that acutely. Shipyards, once bustling, fell silent. Jobs disappeared. It's hard to overstate the impact on those communities.
So what's the government supposed to do in the face of all this? How do you even begin to address that scale of economic upheaval?
Well, they knew they couldn't just sit on their hands. They had to adapt. The Industries Development Act of 1945, that was a key part of their strategy. The idea was to attract new industries, diversify the economy. They offered incentives, tax breaks, grants, even subsidized land. Anything to make Northern Ireland an attractive place to set up shop.
It sounds like they were pulling out all the stops to jumpstart things. Did it work? Did they manage to bring in those new industries?
To some extent, yes. They did create thousands of new jobs, particularly in sectors like light engineering and technology. But, and there's always a but, isn't there? The geographical distribution of these new industries, well, that's where things get a little thorny.
Because those opportunities, they weren't always shared equally. Again.
Unfortunately, no. A significant chunk of these new industries, they ended up concentrated east of the River Ban in predominantly Protestant areas. And that's where you see that phrase, west of the Ban, taking on a whole new layer of meaning.
A term loaded with a lot of historical baggage, reflecting that sense of being left behind, of being deliberately disadvantaged.
Exactly. Catholic areas, particularly those west of the Ban, like Derry City, they felt it most acutely. It's like their economic anxieties were being compounded by this sense of being overlooked, of not benefiting from this supposed progress.
It makes you think, doesn't it, about the unintended consequences of well-intentioned policies, how even when striving for positive change, those echoes of past inequalities can reverberate in ways you might not expect. And as if these economic anxieties weren't enough, this period also saw renewed calls for a united Ireland.
Right.
That sentiment, it never really went away.
It didn't. And groups like the Irish Anti-Partition League, right, formed in 1945, they gave voice to that aspiration. Now, they weren't about violence or anything like that. They believed in peaceful methods, rallies, marches, international campaigns to raise awareness about partition. They even sought support from the government and the Republic of Ireland.
And what was the response like from the Republic? Was there an appetite there for reunification?
It was complicated. In 1948, the Irish government, they passed the Republic of Ireland Act, formally declaring themselves a republic. It was a huge moment, cutting those remaining constitutional ties with the British crown. For some, it was seen as a step toward a united Ireland.
But Britain, they weren't just going to stand by idly, were they? There had to be a reaction from London.
Oh, there was. They countered with the Ireland Act of 1949. It basically reaffirmed Northern Ireland's place within the United Kingdom. No ifs, ands, or buts. It stated that Northern Ireland would remain part of the UK unless the Parliament of Northern Ireland itself voted to leave.
So the door was theoretically open, but with a unionist-dominated parliament in Northern Ireland, not likely to happen.
Exactly. And this dashed the hopes of many who saw the Republic of Ireland Act as a catalyst for unification. The dream was still alive, but the path forward was murkier than ever.
And in this climate of uncertainty, there were those who felt that peaceful methods weren't enough, that more drastic measures were needed to achieve their goals.
You're talking about the IRA. They'd been relatively quiet in the immediate post-war years, but they saw an opportunity in all this uncertainty. And so began the IRA's border campaign, launched in 1956.
A campaign that marked a return to violence.
Sadly, yes. Their targets included government buildings, infrastructure, anything they saw as representing British presence in Northern Ireland. It's important to note, though, that this campaign, it didn't have widespread support, and it was ultimately ineffective. Both the Northern Irish and Republic of Ireland governments condemned the violence.
So much happening. Social reforms, economic upheaval, a resurgence of calls for a united Ireland, even violence. It's a lot for any leader to navigate. And at the helm of it all was Lord Brookborough. He's a figure who seems to embody the contradictions of this era, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
On one hand, he's overseeing the implementation of the welfare state, the expansion of healthcare, education reforms, those social safety nets. Those are significant achievements. But at the same time, he's deeply suspicious of any talk of a united Ireland. He's a staunch unionist, often accused of favoring Protestants over Catholics, especially when it came to housing and economic development. That West of the Ban issue, it rears its head again and again.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Northern Ireland's journey from 1943 to 1963, what's the key takeaway for our listeners? What should they really remember about this period?
I think it boils down to this. It was an era of immense hope, but also immense complexity. The welfare state, for all its flaws and inconsistencies, it did improve the lives of many in Northern Ireland. But it couldn't erase those deep-seated sectarian divisions, those inequalities that continued to simmer beneath the surface.
The promise of progress was there, but the reality was far messier, far more entangled with the legacy of the past. It's a reminder that change is rarely linear, that even with the best of intentions, the path forward is rarely straightforward.
Well said. And in many ways, this period laid the groundwork for the turbulent decades that would follow. The Troubles, those years of conflict that would grip Northern Ireland, their roots can be traced back to this era of both progress and persistent division.
It's a lot to process, a lot to unpack, and it leaves us with more questions than answers, doesn't it? What if those resources, those opportunities, had been shared more equitably from the start? Could things have unfolded differently?
Those are the questions that historians, policymakers, even everyday citizens are still grappling with today. It reminds us that history is never truly settled, that the choices made, the paths taken, they continue to shape the world we live in.
It's a powerful note to end on. Thank you, everyone, for joining us on this deep dive into a pivotal chapter in Northern Ireland's story. We'll be back next time with another journey into the past. Until then, keep exploring, keep questioning, and most importantly, keep learning.